Check 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25. There we go. Check, check, check. 2, 3, 4. Go ahead, James. Can you say something in the... Good morning, everybody. You're listening to Enlightened Radio.
Testing.
We're doing a little mic check here. I know it's exciting to listen to, I just say that because I see we have 35 listeners already on here this morning, so that's welcome. We're getting ready to start Recovery Radio here in a minute. One, two, three. I see, but you're on...
Test.
Can you... can't
hear my mic.
You can't hear. Okay. How about now? Check.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now you're there.
Now we're good.
Now you're good? Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. And, okay, you ready for me to start the music here?
Yes, sir.
And then we can get ready for your phone call in a few minutes here. Let me get that.
Yeah.
Good morning and welcome to Recovery Radio. Beautiful song. We're going to be talking about Shannon's journey this morning. I really like that song. The lyrics are very interesting. And so here on Recovery Radio this morning, we get the opportunity, hopefully, to take a look at the lyrics and listen to the music and talk to the young lady, Shannon, that asked that I play here on Recovery Radio that song because it's relative to her journey. And she's going to be calling in a few minutes. And in the meantime, So Far Away was the name of the song, and it's by Stained. So Far Away. It's a beautiful song. A lot of lyrics that are seem to be kind of heartwarming, and I'm really anxious to find out why Shannon chose that song, and you'll be able to tie it all together as we talk about recovery and we talk about staying stopped from substance abuse and try to get a feel for what it is that we can do to help to meet the needs of people as they struggle with addiction and returning from an addicted state of mind, you know, to where you're feeling hopeless and helpless. And then some things start to happen in your life that are really interesting to listen to. So I hope you stay tuned in or even listen to this podcast on demand. It'll be on my Facebook page. That's Recovery Radio and James Boyd. And kind of join in the conversation. We're down here in beautiful Bolivar, West Virginia. And down at the Red Caboose. Yeah. Hello, caller. Are you there?
Hi, James. It's Shannon. How are you?
Good morning, Shannon. How are you? Can you come a little closer to your phone or your whatever it is that we'll be interviewing you on this morning? How's the reception there? Is it good for you? Because this is really important. I don't want our listening audience to miss anything. So how you doing? Yeah. Yeah, you're doing okay this morning?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. You go ahead.
Just go ahead and this is John, the engineer. Just go ahead and just say a few things so I'll make sure I got your level right, okay?
Yeah, go ahead, Shannon. You up.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Good morning.
I definitely wanted to do part two of my story because I know so many people who are out there struggling. We all know what it's like to struggle as an active drug user, all the pain and misery associated with it. And then we normally just hear people tell their stories, and then now they're clean and so happy and everything's roses. But I think a lot of people want to know how they did it. What was it like those first few months and the first year? And I want to get real with the struggle I had getting and maintaining my sobriety, because I'd love to say it was easy, it was full of sunshine, and that's definitely not the case, you know. Especially in the beginning, I fought it almost every step of the way.
Yeah.
When I knew it was something I wanted.
Shannon, let me slow you down for a minute. Introduce yourself to the world. And who you're Shannon, and you're married, and you have children, and yeah, take us through that.
I have 2.5 years sober from a lifelong active IV drug use and alcoholism. And I went to my first rehab at 13, hit a whole bunch of rehabs between then and when I got sober. I've had endocarditis twice from my drug use. And the second time I had endocarditis, they didn't think I was going to make it. They took me back for surgery, told my husband to go home and get our three daughters because I wasn't going to survive the surgery. The odds were definitely against me. And right before I went for my second open heart surgery, I didn't care if I lived or died. I would try to overdose almost on a daily basis because I couldn't get clean. I didn't think I'd ever be able to get clean. Mm-hmm. I thought my children and everyone who loved me would be better if I was not here because of all the pain I was putting them through. But by the grace of God, I survived the surgery. I had amazing doctors who wouldn't let me give up on me. And okay. it was a struggle, especially there at first, because I wanted to be clean. I wanted to be that parent for my kids. I wanted to be that good mom. I wanted to be the good wife, the good neighbor, the good daughter, the good sibling. And I didn't think that was possible. I thought I had fallen way too far to ever be redeemed.
And how many times in succession? Tell us about the first time you relapsed. And what can you kind of, in hindsight, talk about what caused the first relapse? Give us the overall picture. And we're starting at number one.
When I was 13, went to my first rehab, I didn't think I really had a problem. I thought I was just a normal kid who smoked pot and got drunk all the time. It didn't occur to me that normal 13-year-olds don't do that. In high school, I just hung out with, I immediately honed in on the other kids who smoked pot and drank. And even though they didn't do it quite as much as I did, it justified in my brain that everybody smokes pot. Everybody drinks. I'm just a kid having fun. I had my first daughter at 16.
Okay.
And had quit smoking and drinking after she was born. I started smoking pot again. Got pregnant with my second daughter a day before graduation. I found out I was pregnant day before graduation, and so I stopped smoking pot again.
And what age were you at this time? High school graduation?
I didn't hear you.
You high school graduation you're talking about?
Yes, high school graduation. I found out I was pregnant with my second daughter. Mm-hmm. At 18, I got married, bought a house, moved out of my mom's house, and was living the quote-unquote American dream, you know, the house, the dog, two kids, and things went well. But then I figured because I was living a life of an adult, I should be able to drink. Started really drinking heavily daily, got in a car accident, got prescribed Vicoprofen, and went to the races from there. The first time I tried to get help, I had tried to detox at home, but I really didn't know what I was doing, so it never really worked. I had gotten federal charges because of my drug use and went to try to detox through a Suboxone clinic. Mm-hmm. It was a two-week detox. I didn't know anything about maintenance. Mm-hmm. After the 2 weeks, my anxiety was through the roof, and I was so tired, and I had two small kids, and I was like, there's no way I can take care of them and function. I need something to give me energy, to help me feel better so I can be a mom to my kids. Okay. And I just justified that I could just take a pill, maybe one a day. And of course that didn't work. And as my addiction grew, so did my tolerance.
So wait, tell us what kind of pills you were taking.
It was the Vicoprofen and then oxycodone. And then I eventually, when they became too expensive,
so you would take those. You would take those in conjunction. Let me ask you, so we can clarify. So you would take the two pills that you just named at the same time. You would take them separately. How many times a day did you take these pills?
Oh, I would take my plan was just to take one. To take it as it was originally prescribed. Even though they, at this point, they weren't being prescribed to me anymore, but my tolerance grew, so I was ending up taking, five pills every 2 hours, or with the Oxycontin, I began to snort a pill every few hours, and then as that became too expensive, I turned to heroin, and a quote-unquote friend showed me how to shoot heroin, and then I was shooting heroin pretty much almost every couple hours just to maintain, to keep from getting sick.
Okay.
I had, during this time, I had realized, okay, I need to stop this. And I would go to detoxes and try to detox, but every time I got out, I would get into this panic, like, oh my God, I got to get high. I can't function like this. My anxiety was through the roof.
So tell us how that feels physically when you can't function like this. How does that feel physically, not the emotional part?
It was awful. I was so just physically exhausted. My entire body was sore. It hurt.
Like you've been running or exercising or
regulate.
Wait, I want us to understand what the physical feeling is like completely. You said your body was sore. So I've been sore. Oh. Like after I haven't lift weights in a long time and tried it. Or
maybe a little like that, but I would always describe it as I feel like I've been hit by a freight train.
Well, if you've never been hit by a freight train, let's do a little comedy here a little bit for people. Because I think most of us have never been hit by a freight train, but we can imagine what it might feel like. But to say that we know what it feels like to be hit by a freight train. So let's dig, let's give them something a little deeper than that. Something you felt. So you ever been cut?
I have. I think the best way is when I would even go to lift my arm, it felt like there was 100-pound weight on my arm.
Okay, we're getting there.
I felt so heavy.
So can you go to work like that?
What's that?
Can you go to work heavy like that? Can you work a job?
Oh, no. I couldn't get out of bed. I mean, every movement took a tremendous amount of effort.
Okay, Shannon, and now you're explaining it to me, girl. I can see now how that would feel. So keep going. Tell me about your heaviness.
Just sitting up in bed, it was exhausting. Mm-hmm. It felt like I had all this weight on me, and my joints just burned, and it hurt so bad. I mean, it just hurt. Everything was heavy. Mm-hmm. Everything burned.
What about the headache?
My body temperature wouldn't regulate.
Uh-huh. What did it do to your eyes? How did your eyes feel?
They were so heavy. It felt like I had weights on my eyelids, and I would be sweating, but freezing cold. The cold sweats. And
What about the internal? Let's get a little graphic and raunchy here, because you know heroin addiction and sickness from heroin does stuff to your insides. What happens on the inside, like your regulation?
There is no regulation. Everything comes out that you put in within a few minutes. I had diarrhea for weeks, and I was so nauseous I couldn't even brush my teeth without gagging or throwing up.
So at home doing all this, you really are in a good mood, right? What's your mood like at home with people?
I don't want to be bothered. My skin hurt. I didn't want to be touched. I didn't want to be bothered. And I had two small kids at home that I was physically unable to get up out of bed and even cook them breakfast.
But they understood, right? They understood that.
Oh, yeah. Of course, my husband would be like, you know, I don't understand what the problem is. You detox. And they would say that, you know, I was going through post-acute withdrawal and it would last 6 months to a year. And in my head, all I could think of was, I can't be like this for 6 months. I don't want to be like this now. I can't do it. I physically and mentally, it broke me down, and I would fly off the handle over little things. I would cry over nothing. I was miserable. There was no joy in the early, those times when I tried to detox or go to rehab. I was miserable. And I was, of course, at home because I kept trying to do it at home. And nobody understood. They thought because I had stopped using, I should be normal again. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be normal, but the only way I knew to feel normal physically and mentally was to get high. Mm-hmm. And of course, every time I relapsed, it was just going to be for that day so I could feel better, stop pooping my brains out, stop gagging over everything, make it so my body wouldn't hurt so I could be there for my kids, because I was a lump on a log. And then I would relapse, and it was just going to be the one time. And then the next day, something would come up, and I would justify in my head, okay, I got to get high again so I can do this, and then I'm not going to do it again. Mm-hmm. And that never worked. There was always something I had to be there for. I could not physically just rest and let this pass. I had a life that I couldn't check out of, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
In 2005, it had gotten really bad. My mom said, look, you're going to rehab, and drove me to Pennsylvania. And I was like, oh, hell. They kept me in the detox room of that treatment center for over a week. Mm-hmm. And they said I was one of the worst detoxes they had in a long time. They almost transferred me to the hospital because I was so sick. I was violently throwing up. I was violently having diarrhea. I was drenching the sheets. And it was to the point where I would be sound asleep and have a using dream where I'd be in my dream and I would be dreaming that I was about to feel better. And I would, in my dream, I would put the needle in my neck because that's where I was shooting up. And then at that point, I would wake up and dry heave everywhere because I hadn't had any water or food. And I would just dry heave for like 20 minutes, fall asleep, go back into the same using dream, wake up, dry heave for 20 minutes, fall back asleep for 10, 15 minutes. This went on for a week. It was awful. At the end of the week, I finally started to feel better. I remember I went outside to smoke a cigarette, and evidently I smelled lovely. There were two other people out there, and they just straight walked away from me. I didn't know why they were walking away, and at that point, I really didn't care. It wasn't until later that they were like, you stunk. And I was like, really? They're like, oh, God, you stunk. And it occurred to me, I hadn't bathed in a week. And I had been throwing up everywhere, sweating gallons of sweat. I think I may have even pooped my pants because I couldn't move. My body hurt too much, and I just was too weak to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
I was in that treatment for 4 months and then went to a halfway house. During those 4 months, you know, it was a 12-step-based rehab, so I was forced to get up, and I think the routine of being forced to get up and do stuff helped me feel better physically. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to get up, but the more I got up and moved around, the better I felt.
Yeah.
However, my body temperature still didn't regulate for about 6 months. I would be sweating when I was cold, sweating. I must have sweat probably a good 20 pounds during those few months.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to a halfway house, came home, and got pregnant with my youngest daughter.
Well, let me ask you. So while you were in that particular rehab, was there any medically assisted treatment going on, or they were just...
No, they medically detoxed you,
mm-hmm.
but you were to be abstinent.
Okay, total abstinence.
They promoted abstinence.
Total abstinence.
Yeah. So I was just doing what I was told because that was safe for me.
Mm-hmm.
I came home, got pregnant, was active member in a 12-step group, had sponsees, had service positions. I gave birth to my daughter. She was 8.5 pounds. And after I gave birth, the nurse came in with the Percocet. My husband said, are you sure you want to take that? Mm-hmm. I said, I just had an 8.5 pound daughter. You need to go somewhere with that. I'm taking this pill.
Mm-hmm.
And looking back, that was a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, I had my daughter. We came home when she was 4 weeks old.
Were you using while you were pregnant? Did you tell us?
No, this was after I had the baby.
Okay.
I didn't. They knew I was in recovery.
Mm-hmm.
But they also knew I just had an 8.5 pound baby. So they were like, take this for the pain. And I didn't take any home. But I remember I took that Percocet in the hospital, and I just had this wave of warmth come over me. Mm-hmm. And I was happy, no worries in the world for a good 2 or 3 hours. Mm-hmm. I come home with the baby. I caught a few resentments towards the people in my 12-step meeting. I felt like they weren't there supporting me. I needed extra support because the hormones were going crazy. And I feel like they all just kind of backed off when I had the baby. Didn't really care how I was doing. It was like out of sight, out of mind. And I really got upset about that, not realizing people have other things to do. And it just, between the hormones and everything. And then my friend was diagnosed with stage 4 kidney cancer and relapsed. So I went searching for this person, and he was getting high in D.C., and I got him, brought him back home, and he had pills, and I was like, well,
so
you know,
tell me, Shannon, let's take a look at something here for me, just a second. So why did you really go to D.C.?
I went to D.C., because this person was someone who, during my addiction, I ended up having an affair and almost left my husband to be with this man.
Okay.
I cared for him a lot, and I just wanted to get him because I thought I could fix him.
Okay.
You know, but...
What about Shannon at this time? Okay, so take me real slow through this, Shannon.
Okay.
So we're going to D.C., but before you go to D.C., Did you talk to him?
I talked to him. He told me where he was at.
Did he tell you he had the Percocets? Did he tell you he had the Percocets in his possession?
He was actually told me he was down there smoking crack and got some heroin. And at this point, because he did have stage 4 cancer, he had Dilaudid at home. That I thought, if I could just go get him and bring him home.
What do you, but you was going to get you something. Wait a minute. Take me slow, Shannon. Cause I want my audience to know that Shannon and I are part of the peer recovery, coaching staff and alumni. And so we're talking about stuff that actually on Recovery Radio, we not only want to help those who are still sick and struggling with addiction, and to help those who have no idea what it is that a person endures and goes through and even put themselves through. And this helps us as well, because I am in recovery as well. And Shannon knows that. And we're talking straight from the hip. And so the questions that I'm asking, you know, Shannon has given me permission. So I don't want nobody to threaten to bust my head open or nothing. I'm just being facetious. Go ahead.
You're telling me what was the real reason, and I'm sitting here, and I think if I'm honest with myself,
you must be.
Me wanted to save him.
You must be, because you're part of the Pontifex.
Part of me missed the chaotic lifestyle.
Yes, yes.
You know, I was bored. Yes. I was lonely.
Preach, sister. Go ahead.
The adrenaline that you addicts have when we're out there in the bad part of town, talking to random people we don't know, trying to find things. There's a level of excitement in that.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I really missed, was the excitement of being in that environment, as toxic as it was.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't fulfilled in my recovery, and I thought, okay, I'll get my dose of excitement. I'll grab him, bring him home.
Mm-hmm.
And I got him, brought him back home, but he didn't want to stop. He was like, I'm dying anyway. What does it matter?
Okay.
And I said, okay, well, I'll hang out with you. But he didn't want to hang out with me he wanted to hang out with other people who are involved in that chaotic lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And I had caught a resentment towards the people in my 12-step group. So I was like, you know what? I can do it one time and I'll be fine. I'm just going to do it this one time and hang out with him. And anyone who's struggled with addiction knows you can't do it just one time.
It's like Lay's potato chips, huh? I bet you can't eat just one.
It turned into
the whole bag.
Chaotic use. He ended up passing away a few months later, and when he passed away,
I'm sorry to hear
I
that.
Was worse off than before. Yeah. I was shooting dope every day with a newborn baby at home, and I was trying to hide the fact that I had relapsed, but there was no hiding it. It was pretty obvious.
And so what did you do to try and hide it? Let's give our people some little bit of comedy stuff, because sometimes when we using and trying to figure out what to do, it can be very comical once you look back on it. So take a look at yourself for us, in front of us. So what are some of the ways that you tried to hide your addiction?
Well,
you can take a minute.
I had already blown all the veins in my arms.
Oh, you had track marks that were obvious?
Yes.
Okay.
And then I began shooting in my legs and in my groin.
Okay.
Because nobody could see that.
Okay.
And my feet, I would shoot in my feet, and if I missed a little bit, my whole foot would swell up. I couldn't even put shoes on because it would, I guess, something irritated.
Was there a harm reduction program for you to go to at that time?
What?
Harm reduction? Was there a needle exchange program going on, as they like to call it, but it's more than that? Harm reduction, was that available?
There was one in D.C., but I wasn't going to D.C. At that time, I could purchase boxes of needles over the counter at the pharmacy.
Just
and
walk in and
thought,
get a box.
I did not share needles, that I was okay.
Yeah.
I wasn't that bad because I never shared needles. I would use the same needle over and over and over and over again, but I didn't share it with anybody.
So, because those things can get pretty expensive, right?
They weren't too bad. For a box of 100, it was about $20-$25.
Okay. That's a month? 2 weeks?
Well, normally I would get a box and everybody would be like, oh, you have new works, give me some, and I would pass it out. So I was probably spending about $100 a month in needles.
And cigarettes as well, right?
Oh, Lordy, yes.
Okay, we're doing some math here now, because you know I like mathematics. That's why I say 8,000 days, and everybody want to do adding and subtracting, and once you get on that slippery slope, you get into multiplication quick, right?
Oh, I calculated over my addiction between the rehab, the drugs, and everything. I've spent probably close to $800,000.
Okay, over a span of
25 years.
25 years, $800,000. So when you retire whatever time your body says you need to sit down, $800,000 clean and sober would go a long ways towards living a pretty good life. So we've done that already, right? And we ain't retired yet. So we need to get that 800 grand back.
Yeah.
I'm telling you.
Really,
and your story is worth
that
and
I'm
more.
Sober,
go ahead.
I think back on all the money I took away from my kids, all that could have gone towards, you know, soccer lessons, horseback riding lessons, private school, or just to make a nice retirement for me. And it's very upsetting at times, but I can't go back and get that money, you know?
Well, but you still owe it.
Money from my family.
Wait.
I did things,
Shannon,
that
let me say
I was
this
raised
to
not to do. I stole. I lied, yeah. I cheated, I pawned, and I would steal from grocery stores, I would steal from family members, and I would go to the pawn shop, and I pawned my dead grandfather's retirement ring, and, you know, for $50, when that ring was worth probably a couple thousand. I just needed to get high, and it didn't occur to me that I would regret that. And that is one thing that I really struggled with when I got sober, was all the regret.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the time that I can't get back, that I wasted. I think as addicts, that's the one thing that really kills us, is all the time that we wasted that could have been spent forming relationships, building bonds, you know, whether it be with our family or our kids, we can't get that time back. And that is something I really struggled with in the beginning of my recovery this time. I can't get that time back. And
no, you can't.
I spent so much of my addiction lying to people and trying to hide, and I lied to myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as addicts, we lie to ourselves a lot. I know I would I wanted to get clean so bad, but my addiction led me to believe that there was no way I was going to be able to. The people who had recovered,
mm-hmm.
in my mind, I thought, okay, they recovered because they weren't as bad as me.
Okay.
They didn't have it as bad as me. Anyone who used as much dope as me on a daily basis, there was no way they could ever get clean and stay clean. It was mm-hmm. impossible.
Mm-hmm.
That is the thinking that I had. And I had just given up on ever being able to get and maintain sobriety.
And so it sounds like something, so this is what it sounds like. Informative, performative self-loathing. Informative, performative self-loathing. Loathing.
That's exactly what it was.
If you can kind of unwrap that, because, you know, I believe that the things that we tell ourselves when we're falling into that deep, deep, dark abyss is contrary to what God believes about you. Because I want to read you something that Senator Unger sent. He said, from what Ralph Waldo Emerson, who wrote, "To know even one life has breathed easier because you have lived. This is to have succeeded." And so to know that one life has lived because you're telling your story is indicative of a successful life. And so, you know, it's really heartwarming and heart-wrenching at the same time, you know, to hear from you, Shannon, but I am so grateful that you're willing, you're able to be part of something that's much bigger than the both of us. And so, you know, I thank you
Amen.
For that. But to get back to your story, that's all right. Wait. You can do that because we still have a few minutes and I need some details from you because I think because it's very interesting, you know, especially about the, you know, because we're both involved in the harm reduction programs in Berkeley and Jefferson counties, it's important for people to hear about what can happen when you are intravenous in your delivery. And also, you said that you snorted, and I'm curious to know what is the sensation, especially with the pills. Does it burn? How does your body feel when you get a miss?
Well, when you snort, it burns. When I switched to heroin, I couldn't snort anymore because my sinuses had just been destroyed from snorting.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you something so that we can get the naysayers and the negativity out of the way for people who would listen. Does this constitute war stories that we're having here, and will it lead you to relapse today? Are you thinking about using as you tell your story? Because I don't want to be party to anything like
that. Not at all.
Okay, Shannon. There we go.
Everybody knows how to use who's an addict.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I really want to, I'm going to skip forward a little bit so I can try to help somebody by letting them know what early recovery was like. I had gotten an endocarditis.
Mm-hmm.
I had permanent clots in my groin from scar tissue and from shooting up in my groin. When I woke up, they didn't think I was going to make it through surgery. I woke up after surgery, raging mad, cussing everybody out. I had to get intubated because I started to crash. And I remember they were trying to put this mask on me, and I kept smacking it off. And they were like, if you don't wear the mask, we're going to have to incubate you. And I told the nurse, then effing incubate me. And that was the last thing I remember. I remember waking up in the hospital, and I had a doctor standing over me. They pulled out the tube, because I was on a breathing tube, and he said, how are you feeling? And I remember I looked at him, I said, if you send me home, I am going to die. And he put his head in his hands and said, okay. I said, I'm serious. You cannot send me home. I need help. And it was funny because I had been unconscious, but I woke up, and that, to me, that was divine intervention. God gave me the ability for my first words to say, help me. And all those doctors, bless their heart, they did. But I was the biggest pain in the ass they had ever seen, I'm sure. Well, I don't want to say that, but I wanted the help. I wanted to get clean. I just had my second open heart surgery in 4 years. And their plan, they were going to detox me.
And how old were you at the time, if you don't mind me asking?
Incubated.
How old were you?
And they gave me this was two and a half years ago.
Okay.
So I was 35.
Okay. Well, and you're brave telling your age. I thought women didn't do that. Go ahead.
Wean me off the pain medicine and then transfer me to Suboxone. And that's what I really wanted. I did not understand how powerful fear was. Fear is a powerful emotion. And they were tapering me down. They got me off the IV pain meds, onto oral pain meds. But I would hide the Dilaudid under my tongue. And as soon as they went out of the room, I would spit it out, go in the bathroom, and crush it up and shoot it into my PICC line. Mind you, I just had my second open heart surgery for endocarditis, which is an infection of the heart. I had a pacemaker. If any of that would have gotten infected, I would have died right there. In my mind, I was like, it's not going to get infected because I'm on these antibiotics and they're not giving me enough. I need to feel better. The fact of the matter was, I didn't want to feel physical pain and I didn't want to feel any pain. And I had to. And I got caught shooting the Dilaudid in my PICC line. They took everything out of my room, all the phone. They told my husband to take my cell phone. They had a babysitter in there with me, and I got pissed. I was like, I am not a child. You're not taking my cell phone. I don't care what any of y'all say. And I cussed them all out because I had been out of control for so long. I wanted to be in control of something, but yet my active addiction brain was still, it was in like overdrive at this time. It was, we can't do this. We're not going to be able to stay sober, Shannon. You don't feel good. You've got to get high right now. Just shoot this pill. It's going to be okay. You're not going to get another infection because you're on antibiotics. Just the irrational thinking. I don't think I had a rational thought for the first few months. Everything, I fought it every step of the way. By the grace of God, these doctors did not give up on me. Well, I told them, I begged them not to give up on me, even though I was the biggest pain in the ass.
Well, let me ask you. Let me ask your opinion about something that I find about myself: diminished capacity. You just said that you couldn't make any kinds of rational decisions. Would you say that you're, from what you know about capacity, diminished capacity, just that statement alone, how do you find that ties into your journey, your capacity to make sound decisions?
I made no rational decisions at all when I was using. I mistaked false goods for real goods. In my definition of a true good is something that benefits others and will continue to be a benefit the next day.
So you would put a check mark in the diminished capacity box. Is that true?
What's that?
So you would put a check mark in the diminished capacity box.
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
I had to learn how to live again. I had to learn how to be a functioning member of society. I had to change my thinking because for so long, I lied, cheated, stole, manipulated to survive in my addictive lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
When you're an addict, you can't be nice to other people and get what you want. Mm-hmm. You have to manipulate the situation, and it becomes second nature.
Okay. Okay, let's get back. Let's get back to the pill. Let's get back to the pick line. You thought you got away, didn't you? Take us back to the pick line, because I think you got caught, didn't you?
Yeah, I got caught. They were poos. And I wasn't messing with it. I got caught red-handed.
So did you lie? Did you try to lie?
I lied.
Did you try to tell a lie?
What's that?
You tried to lie? You said, I didn't.
Oh, hell yeah. I was like, no, I found this in the trash, and they weren't buying it, you know, but I was hell-bent on sticking to my story. And after that point, they had somebody stay in the room with me, go to the bathroom with me.
Oh, my goodness.
I was not allowed to be alone, and I was pissed.
So somebody had to do an extra shift because you was messing up.
Yeah. I was still very self-destructive.
Uh-huh.
And I remember when they finally, I was down to, it was the day before they were going to start the Suboxone because they had to wean me off everything. And I remember sitting there and I was trying to convince the doctor to give me my last half a milligram of Dilaudid IV so I could go out with a bang. And he was like, absolutely not. And I got pissed over that. I was like, I'm never going to be able to use again in my entire life, and you won't give me this. He said, nope. And I was like, well, fuck. Pardon my French. I was pissed. And then I got on the Suboxone, and after about 2 weeks, they transferred me to a nursing home. And it was nice, because on the Suboxone, I wasn't having cravings. My body temperature regulated. I was still having diarrhea, but they said that would stop. It could have been from the antibiotics. And I went to this nursing home
mm-hmm.
where a bunch of the people there were selling drugs in the lobby, because it wasn't just like a rehab for addicts. It was an actual nursing home, because I couldn't go home with the pick one. And I remember at that point, I realized I need to do something to change, because if I don't get help to change my thought process, I'm never going to get and stay clean, and I'm going to end up dying.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that the image of my oldest girls standing in the doorway of the ICU and a look of utter disgust on their face.
Mm-hmm.
And it broke my heart, because I knew they were pissed at me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm supposed to be their mother. I'm supposed to take care of them and protect them.
Mm-hmm.
And here they are having to look after me because I almost died.
Okay.
And at that moment, I said, okay, I'm going to do whatever it takes. And again, I wish I could have done it, said that from that point on, it was smooth sailing. I didn't fight it, but I did.
Okay.
It took me a long time to realize this is a process. I'm still learning to this day. I had a lot of guilt. Okay. I didn't know how to get over the guilt.
Mm-hmm.
And then someone told me, to get over that guilt, you go out and you create new positive memories. And with the new positive memories, mm-hmm. it dilutes the painful guilt memories.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, isn't that a concept? So I started doing things with my kids that I made it an effort every day to spend quality time, whether going down to the river with the girls or just mm-hmm. playing a board game, doing something to reconnect
mm-hmm.
with my kids.
Yeah, you started to mastermind your own recovery trail. You started to take control of your recovery trail, the trail that you were
exactly.
on.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
you started
I made
to build bridges.
Say, look, if I do something, I need you guys to point it out. I started taking criticism constructively, not thinking it was a personal attack on me,
mm-hmm.
but realizing if someone says, hey, you're being really defensive,
mm-hmm.
or hey, you're being really irrational, you need to calm down, I didn't automatically, no, I'm not, and put that wall up and get even more defensive. I would stop and take a time out and say, okay, why am I acting like this? Mm-hmm. I realized I choose what mood I'm in every day. Mm-hmm. I can choose to walk around in a pissed off mood, or I can choose to be like, I'm going to have a good day today.
Yeah.
And be in a good mood.
Mm-hmm.
My moods, my attitude is my choice.
Mm-hmm.
And I have that choice now.
Mm-hmm.
And because I'm aware I have that choice now, I can either make the most of it,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, just be, I mean, I'm not saying I'm full of sunshine and rainbows any day by any means.
Okay.
You know, everybody has bad days, but when we realize we can either stay in the negative, stay in the problem, or be part of the solution,
mm-hmm.
it gives us power that we didn't have when we were using.
Yeah. Well, let me say this to you. Let me say this to you.
I was a slave to my addiction.
Shannon, I want to try and help out here. So whenever you, from this point, when you wake up and you're having a bad day, give me a call and give it to me, because I got a place where I put those. And so if you ever get a couple, or you just one, or you know somebody that's having bad days, you know, just send them my way, and I because I got a storage bin that I put bad days in, you know, and it's full right now. So if you know of anybody that you would like to give them a bad day, I got one for you. like some of the folks that are turning a blind eye. And Shannon, I believe that you have to have a blind eye in order to turn one. So those are the folks that need a bad day. So, but we're having good days from this point, Shannon, and it's really, really an honor. We're not done with Shannon's journey. You know, it took what it took. That's the title of the podcast today, Shannon's Journey. It took what it took. And there's much more to come, because I'm a pretty good listener, Shannon, and I'm practicing to do that. So I have some more questions for you, because there's a lot of gaps for me in your story.
Yeah,
your story, and I want to help you fill them in. And I believe they're important for recovery, because you said earlier, you said the doctors came in and you woke up. Well, I look at that from a spiritual point of view, because that's how I walked into my recovery journey and my process. It was from a spiritual enlightenment, I'd like to call it. And you woke up. So it seems to me that you really, really woke up. You're choosing life today. Would that be a fair assessment?
Oh, it is. You know, I have an appointment for my pacemaker doctor, and I'm actually, it's in about an hour.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I could, if I was in active addiction, I wouldn't be making any of my appointments. I would let, you know, my physical health deteriorate, which would really be bad considering what I've done to my body. But, you know, today I show up and I live life and I put my health first, because if I'm not healthy, everything around me falls apart.
Yeah.
And, you know, mm-hmm. but it's a different type.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you can be a little hateful when you ain't healthy too. Sound like you get pissed off quick and you'll tell people where to go. So we don't, and I plan to spend a lot of time in meetings and planning meetings and board meetings with you. And so I need to know these things, and you're really helping me, because when you're having a bad day or you're pissed off or something like that, I know how to, you know, kind of stay in your world and be a part of the solution and not the problem. Because so many times, stigma. Can you talk a little bit about stigma?
Oh.
You got about 5 minutes, and we're gonna have to.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I still get the stigma. I mean, when I was actively using and would go to the doctors, I wouldn't tell them I was actively using, because they would just turn their nose at me, and it was awful. So I learned, as an addict, you don't tell the doctors that you're actively using unless you're ready to get help, mm-hmm. because they will treat you like trash. And that is something that I'm slowly seeing the medical community kind of change their attitude on, But if, you know, even to this day, my neighbor the other day had a friend over, and he is one of those people who thinks being an addict is a moral failing. Mm-hmm. That, you know, addicts choose to destroy their life. Addicts choose to, you know, treat their loved ones like trash. And I'm like, if it wasn't a choice for me, if it was a choice, I would have never chosen to steal my daughter's pain medicine after surgery. I would have never chosen to steal my mom's jewelry and pawn it. I would have never chosen to do so many of the horrible things associated with my addiction. I would have chose to stop and be the soccer mom my kids deserve, but I couldn't. And I think that's something that these people don't realize. I'll go to the hospital now, and I have no IV access. And if I need to get blood work done, I'm always like, ugh. They're like, well, let's find somebody else. But then we'll get some people that are like, you know what? Good for you. You're sober now. I know that was hard. Keep up the good work. And it's like the hot and cold. And with my neighbors, some of them know I'm in recovery, but some don't, because I don't want them. So many people think addicts are less than. But they're bad people. Addicts, from what I've seen, addicts are not bad people trying to get good. They're sick people trying to get well.
Yes.
And
I believe that.
Just the way society treats those who are still suffering in active addiction is really disheartening.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about what you're doing this today about helping, being part of the solution. Well, for me, I stay stopped.
Oh, well, I'm in the recovery coaching class with you, James, mm-hmm. and I reach out to the addicts who are suffering and give them resources if they're wanting to turn around, or just be there for them until they're ready to turn their life around.
And
we're also part of the harm reduction program that's mm-hmm. starting up in Jefferson County. People know it, are more familiar with the term need change, but we do so much more than that.
Yes.
We help people get free testing for HIV and Hep C, give active users sterile needles and cookers, saline, cotton, wound care kits. We go around the community, and if there's areas people have discarded used needles, we go and we're going to be picking that up.
Mm-hmm.
We want to fight for basic human rights of those. They're not bad people. You know, they deserve to be treated with dignity and respect. And I think that we are on our way to setting up something and hopefully the stigma associated with the
Shannon, you're breaking up just a little bit, okay? So we're going to make a little adjustment. But we're about to go off air in just a second. It's really been a delight. Excuse me. And I'm looking forward to the next interview so we can pick up. But I would like for us to get together and make sure we know where we left off. And I have a whole lot of questions. I got about 20 questions in the top of my head already for our next interview. And it should be fun. Maybe we can turn this into a whole series and maybe do this once a month with you. So we can see what the journey is, and if you have people coming along alongside you and we can start this walk together. And just gather as many people as we can, because it takes a village. And so it's been really nice, Shannon. Okay, so we're gonna close out. I mean, I love the pick of the song. I really got to listen to it, and I got the words, and that was perfect, right on for your life. That particular
Amen.
Song. And we're gonna close out with Marvin Gaye. What's going on? Is that okay with you?
That works for me.
All right. It's all about having options. Is that right?
That's right.
I will talk to you soon, Shannon. Thanks for calling in.
All right. Thank you, James.
You're welcome.
Afternoon.
Yeah, that's Recovery Radio. This is Shannon's Journey. It took what it took. Okay, see you all next week.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love. Don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Punish me, sister, with brutality. Sister, talk to me, sister, so you can see, sister, oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
Yeah, what's going on?
What's going on?
Oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
Oh, right on. Right on. Right on. Everybody thinks we're wrong. Oh, but who are they to judge us? Simply cause our hair is long. Oh, you know we've got to find. Bring some understanding here today. Oh, oh, oh. Picket lines and picket signs. Punish me with brutality. Come on, talk to me. You can see what's going on. Yeah, what's going on? Tell me what's going on. I'll tell you what's going on.
Right, right on. Right on.
Start to Somebody shake me, 'cause I'm